You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Man Alive by G.K. Chesterton. Section 6. Part 1. The Enigmas of Innocent Smith. Chapter 2. The Banner of Beacon. Part 2. "What a mistake that is!" cried Innocent Smith, leaping up in great excitement. "All is gold that glitters, especially now we are a sovereign state. What's the good of a sovereign state if you can't define a sovereign? We can make anything precious metal, as men could in the morning of the world. They didn't choose gold because it was rare. Your scientists can tell you 20 sorts of slime much rarer. They choose gold because it was bright, because it was a hard thing to find, but pretty when you found it. You can't fight with golden swords or eat golden biscuits. You can only look at it, and you can look out here." With one of his incalculable motions he sprang back and burst open the doors into the garden. At the same time also, with one of his gestures that never seemed at the instant so unconventional as they were, he stretched out his hand to Mary Gray and led her out on through the lawn as if for a dance. The French windows, thus flung open, let in an evening even lovelier than that of the day before. The west was swimming with sanguine colours, and a sort of sleepy flame lay upon the lawn. The twisted shadows of one or two garden trees showed upon this sheen, not grey or black as in common daylight, but like arabesques written in vivid violet ink on some page of eastern gold. The sunset was one of those festive and yet mysterious conflagrations in which common things, by their colours, remind us of costly or curious things. The slates upon the sloping roof burned like the plumes of a vast peacock, in every mysterious blend of blue and green. The red-brown bricks of the wall glowed with all the October tints of strong ruby and tawny wines. The sun seemed to set each object alight with a different coloured flame, like a man lighting fireworks, and even Innocent's hair, which was of a rather colourless fairness, seemed to have a flame of pagan gold on it as he strode across the lawn towards the one tall ridge of rockery. "What would be the good of gold," he was saying, "if it did not glitter? Why should we care for a black sovereign any more than for a black sun at noon? A black button would do just as well. Don't you see that everything in this garden looks like a jewel? And will you kindly tell me what the deuce is the good of a jewel except that it looks like a jewel? Leave off buying and selling and start looking. Open your eyes, and you'll wake up to the New Jerusalem. All is gold that glitters. Tree and tower of brass rolls the golden evening air down the golden grass. Kick the cry to Jericho, how yellow mud is sold. All is gold that glitters, for the glitter is the gold." "And who wrote that?" asked Rosamund, amused. "No one will ever write it," answered Smith, and cleared the rockery with a flying leap. "Really," said Rosamond to Michael Moon, "he ought to be sent to an asylum, don't you think so?" "I beg your pardon," inquired Michael, rather somberly. His long swarthy head was dark against the sunset, and either by accident or mood he had the look of something isolated and even hostile amid the social extravagance of the garden. "I only said Mr. Smith ought to go to an asylum," repeated the lady. The lean face seemed to grow longer and longer, for Moon was unmistakably sneering. "No," he said, "I don't think it's at all necessary." "What do you mean?" asked Rosamund quickly. "Why not?" "Because he is in one now," answered Michael Moon in a quiet but ugly voice. "Why, didn't you know?" "What?" cried the girl, and there was a break in her voice, for the Irishman's face and voice were really almost creepy. With his dark figure and dark sayings in all that sunshine, he looked like the devil in paradise. "I'm sorry," he continued with a sort of harsh humility. "Of course, we don't talk about it much, but I thought we all really knew."
"Knew what?"
"Well," answered Moon, "that Beacon House is a certain rather singular sort of house, a house with loose tiles, shall we say? Innocent Smith is only the doctor that visits us. Hadn't you come when he called before? As our maladies are melancholic, of course he has to be extra cheery. Sanity, of course, seems very bumptious, eccentric thing to us, jumping over a wall, climbing a tree. That's his bedside manner."
"You daren't say such a thing," cried Rosamund in a rage. "You daren't suggest that I..."
"Not more than I am," said Michael soothingly. "Not more than the rest of us. Haven't you ever noticed that Miss Duke never sits still? A notorious sign. Haven't you ever observed that Inglewood is always washing his hands? A known mark of mental disease. I, of course, am a dipsomaniac."
"I don't believe you," broke out his companion, not without agitation. "I've heard you had some bad habits."
"All habits are bad habits," said Michael with deadly calm. "Madness does not come by breaking out, but by giving in, by settling down in some dirty little self-repeating circle of ideas, by being tamed. You went mad about money because you're an heiress."
"It's a lie," cried Rosamund furiously. "I never was mean about money."
"You were worse," said Michael in a low voice and yet violently. "You thought that other people were. You thought every man who came near you must be a fortune hunter. You would not let yourself go and be sane, and now you're mad, and I'm mad, and serve us right."
"You brute," said Rosamund, quite white. "And is this true?"
With the intellectual cruelty of which the Celt is capable when his abysses are in revolt, Michael was silent for some seconds and then stepped back with an ironical bow. "Not literally true, of course," he said, "only really true. An allegory, shall we say, a social satire?"
"And I hate and despise your satires," cried Rosamund Hunt, letting loose her whole forcible female personality like a cyclone, and speaking every word to wound. "I despise it as I despise your rank tobacco and your nasty, loungy ways and your snarling and your radicalism and your old clothes and your potty little newspaper and your rotten failure at everything. I don't care whether you call it snobbishness or not. I like life and success and jolly things to look at and action. You won't frighten me with Diogenes. I prefer Alexander."
"Victrix causa dare," said Michael gloomily, and this angered her more, as not knowing what it meant, she imagined it to be witty.
"Oh, I dare say you know Greek," she said with cheerful inaccuracy. "You haven't done much with that either." And she crossed the garden, pursuing the vanished Innocent and Mary.
In doing so, she passed Inglewood, who was returning to the house slowly and with a thought-clouded brow. He was one of those men who are quite clever, but quite the reverse of quick. As he came back out of the sunset garden into the twilight parlour, Diana Duke slipped swiftly to her feet and began putting away the tea things. But it was not before Inglewood had seen an instantaneous picture, so unique that he might well have snapshotted it with his everlasting camera. For Diana had been sitting in front of her unfinished work, with her chin on her hand, looking straight out the window in pure, thoughtless thought.
"You are busy," said Arthur, oddly embarrassed with what he had seen and wishing to ignore it.
"There's no time for dreaming in this world," answered the young lady with her back to him.
"I have been thinking lately," said Inglewood in a low voice, "that there's no time for waking up."
She did not reply, and he walked to the window and looked out on the garden. "I don't smoke or drink, you know," he said irrelevantly, "because I think they're drugs. And yet I fancy all hobbies, like my camera and bicycle, are drugs too. Getting under a black hood, getting into a dark room, getting into a hole anyhow.
drugging myself with speed and sunshine and fatigue and fresh air, pedaling the machine so fast that I turn into a machine myself. That's the matter with all of us. We're too busy to wake up."
"Well," said the girl solidly, "what is there to wake up to?"
"There must be," cried Inglewood, turning round in singular excitement. "There must be something to wake up to. All we do is preparations. Your cleanliness and my healthiness and Warner's scientific appliances. We're always preparing for something. Something that never comes off. I ventilate the house and you sweep the house. But what is going to happen in the house?" She was looking at him quietly, but with very bright eyes, and seemed searching for some form of words which she could not find. Before she could speak, the door burst open, and the boisterous Rosamund Hunt, in her flamboyant white hat, boa, and parasol, stood framed in the doorway. She was in a breathing heat, and on her open face was an expression of the most infantile astonishment. "Well, here's a fine game," she said, panting. "What am I to do now, I wonder? I've wired for Dr. Warner. That's all I can think of doing." "What's the matter?" asked Diana, rather sharply, but moving forward like one used to be called upon for assistance. "It's Mary," said the heiress, "my companion Mary Gray. That cracked friend of yours called Smith has proposed to her in the garden after 10 hours' acquaintance, and he wants to go off with her now for a special license." Arthur Inglewood walked to the open French windows and looked out on the garden, still golden with evening light. Nothing moved there but a bird or two, hopping and twittering. But beyond the hedge and railings, in the road outside the garden gate, a hansom cab was waiting, with the yellow Gladstone bag on top of it. The end of chapter 3. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Man Alive by G.K. Chesterton. Section 7, Part 1, The Enigmas of Innocent Smith, Chapter 5, The Garden of the God. Diana Duke seemed inexplicably irritated at the abrupt entrance and utterance of the other girl. "Well," she said shortly, "I suppose Miss Gray can decline him if she doesn't want to marry him." "But she does want to marry him," cried Rosamond in exasperation. "She's a wild, wicked fool, and I won't be parted from her." "Perhaps," said Diana icily, "but I really don't see what we can do." "But the man's balmy, Diana," reasoned her friend angrily. "I can't let my nice governess marry a man that's balmy. You, or somebody, must stop it. Mr. Inglewood, you're a man. Go and tell them they simply can't."
"Unfortunately, it seems to me they simply can," said Inglewood, with a depressed air. "I have far less right of intervention than Miss Duke, besides having, of course, far less moral force than she."
"You haven't either of you got much," cried Rosamund, the last stays of her formidable temper giving way. "I think I'll go somewhere else for a little sense and pluck. I think I know someone who will help me more than you do. At any rate, he's a cantankerous beast, but he's a man, and he has a mind and knows it." And she flung out into the garden with cheeks aflame and the parasol whirling like a Catherine wheel. She found Michael Moon standing under the garden tree, looking over the hedge, hunched like a bird of prey, with his large pipe hanging down his long blue chin. The very hardness of his expression pleased her, after the nonsense of the new engagement and the shilly-shallying of her other friends. "I am sorry I was cross, Mr. Moon," she said frankly. "I hated you for being a cynic, but I've been well punished, for I want a cynic just now. I've had my fill of sentiment. I'm fed up with it. The world's gone mad, Mr. Moon. All except the cynics, I think. That maniac Smith wants to marry my old friend Mary, and she doesn't seem to mind." Seeing his attentive face still undisturbedly smoking, she added smartly, "I'm not joking. That's Mr. Smith's cab outside. He swears he'll take her off now to his aunt's and go for a special license.
Do give me some practical advice, Mr. Moon." Mr. Moon took his pipe out of his mouth, held it in his hand for an instant reflectively, and then tossed it to the other side of the garden. "My practical advice to you is this," he said. "Let him go for his special license, and ask him to get another one for you and me." "Is that one of your jokes?" asked the young lady. "Do say what you really mean." "I mean that Innocent Smith is a man of business," said Moon with ponderous precision. "A plain, practical man. A man of affairs. A man of facts and the daylight. He has let down 20 ton of good building bricks suddenly on my head, and I am glad to say they have woken me up. We went to sleep a little while ago on this very lawn in this very sunlight. We have had a little nap for 5 years or so. But now we're going to be married, Rosamund, and I can't see why that cab..." "Really," said Rosamund stoutly, "I don't know what you mean." "What a lie," cried Michael, advancing on her with brightening eyes. "I'm all for lies in an ordinary way, but don't you see that tonight they won't do? We've wandered into a world of facts, old girl. That grass growing and that sun going down and that cab at the door are facts. You used to torment and excuse yourself by saying I was after your money and didn't really love you. But if I stood here now and I told you I didn't love you, you wouldn't believe me, for truth is in this garden tonight." "Really, Mr. Moon," said Rosamund, rather more faintly. He kept his two big blue magnetic eyes focused on her face. "Is my name Moon?" he asked. "Is your name Hunt? On my honor, they sound to me as quaint and distant as Red Indian names. It's as if your name was Swim and my name was Sunrise. But our real names are Husband and Wife, and they were when we fell asleep." "It's no good," said Rosamund, with real tears in her eyes. "One can never go back." "I can go where I damn please," said Michael, "and I can carry you on my shoulder." "But really, Michael, really, you must stop and think," cried the girl earnestly. "You could carry me off my feet, I dare say, soul and body, but it may be bitter bad business for all that. These things done in that romantic rush, like Mr. Smith's, they do attract women, I don't deny it. As you say, we're all telling the truth tonight. They've attracted poor Mary, for one. They attract me, Michael, but the cold fact remains, imprudent marriages do lead to long unhappiness and disappointment. You've got used to your drinks and things. I shan't be pretty much longer." "Imprudent marriages," roared Michael, "and pray where in earth or heaven are there any prudent marriages? Might as well talk about prudent suicides. You and I have dawdled round each other long enough, and are we any safer than Smith and Mary Gray, who met last night? You never know a husband till you marry him. Unhappy? Of course you'll be unhappy. Who the devil are you that you shouldn't be unhappy, like the mother that bore you? Disappointed? Of course we'll be disappointed. I, for one, don't expect till I die to be so good a man as I am this minute, a tower with all the trumpets shouting." "You see all this," said Rosamund, with grand sincerity in her solid face, "and do you really want to marry me?" "My darling, what else is there to do?" reasoned the Irishman. "What other occupation is there for an active man on this earth except to marry you? What's the alternative to marriage, barring sleep? It's not liberty, Rosamund. Unless you marry God, as our nuns do in Ireland, you must marry man. That is me. The only third thing is to marry yourself. Yourself, yourself, yourself. The only companion that is never satisfied and never satisfactory." "Michael," said Miss Hunt in a very soft voice, "if you won't talk so much, I'll marry you." "It's no time for talking," cried Michael Moon. "Singin's the only thing. Can't you find that mandolin of yours, Rosamund?" "Go and fetch it for me," said Rosamund, with crisp and sharp authority. The lounging Mr. Moon stood for one split second astonished. Then he shot away across the lawn as if shod with the feathered shoes out of the Greek fairy tale. He cleared 3 yards and 15 daisies at a leap out of mere bodily levity, but when he came within a yard or two of the open parlor windows, his flying feet fell in their old manner like lead. He twisted round and came back slowly, whistling. The events of that enchanted evening were not at an end. Inside the dark sitting-room, of which Moon had caught a glimpse, a curious thing had happened. Almost an instant after the intemperate exit of Rosamund, it was something which, occurring in that obscure parlour, seemed to Arthur Inglewood like heaven and earth turning head over heels, the sea being the ceiling and the stars the floor. No words can express how it astonished him, as it astonishes all simple men when it happens. Yet the stiffest female stoicism seemed separated from it only by a sheet of paper or a sheet of steel. It indicates no surrender, far less any sympathy. The most rigid and ruthless woman can begin to cry, just as the most effeminate man can grow a beard. It is a separate sexual power, and proves nothing one way or the other about force of character. But to young men, ignorant of women like Arthur Inglewood, to see Diana Duke crying was like seeing a motor car shedding tears of petrol. He could never have given, even if his really manly modesty had permitted it, any vaguest vision of what he did when he saw that portent. He acted as men do when a theater catches fire, very differently from how they would have conceived themselves as acting, whether for better or worse. He had a faint memory of certain half-stifled explanations that the heiress was the one really paying guest, and she would go, and the bailiffs in consequence would come. But after that he knew nothing of his own conduct except by the protests it evoked. "Leave me alone, Mr. Inglewood, leave me alone. That's not the way to help." "But I can help you," said Arthur, with grinding certainty. "I can, I can, I can." "Why, you said," cried the girl, "that you were much weaker than me." "So I am weaker than you," said Arthur, in a voice that went vibrating through everything, "but not just now." "Let go my hands," cried Diana. "I won't be bullied." In one element, he was much stronger than she, the matter of humor. This leapt up in him suddenly, and he laughed, saying, "Well, you are mean. You know quite well you'll bully me all the rest of my life. You might allow a man the 1 minute of his life when he's allowed to bully." It was as extraordinary for him to laugh as for her to cry, and for the first time since her childhood, Diana was entirely off her guard. "Do you mean you want to marry me?" she said. "Why, there's a cab at the door," cried Inglewood, springing up with an unconscious energy and bursting open the glass doors that led into the garden. As he led her out by the hand, they realized somehow for the first time that the house and garden were on a steep height over London. And yet, though they felt the place to be uplifted, they felt it also to be secret. It was like some round-walled garden on the top of one of the turrets of heaven. Inglewood looked round dreamily, his brown eyes devouring all sorts of details with senseless delight. He noticed for the first time that the railings of the gate beyond the garden bushes were moulded like little spearheads and painted blue. He noticed that one of the blue spears was loosened in its place and hung sideways, and this almost made him laugh. He thought it somehow exquisitely harmless and funny that the railing should be crooked. He thought he should like to know how it happened, who did it, and how the man was getting on. When they were gone a few feet across that fiery grass, they realized that they were not alone. Rosamund Hunt and the eccentric Mr. Moon, both of whom they had at last seen in the blackest temper of detachment, were standing together on the lawn. They were standing in quite an ordinary manner, and yet they looked somehow like people in a book. "Oh," said Diana, "what lovely air!" "I know," called out Rosamund with pleasure so positive that it rang out like a complaint. "It's just like that horrid, beastly, fizzy stuff they gave me that made me feel happy." "Oh, it isn't anything like anything but itself," answered Diana, breathing deeply. "Why, it's all cold, and yet it feels like fire." "Balmy is the word we use in Fleet Street," said Mr. Moon. "Balmy, especially on the crumpet." And he fanned himself quite unnecessarily with his straw hat. They were all full of little leaps and pulsations of objectless and airy energy. Diana stirred and stretched her long arms rigidly, as if crucified, in a sort of excruciating restfulness. Michael stood still for long intervals with gathered muscles, then spun round like a teetotum and stood still again. Rosamund did not trip, for women never trip except when they fall on their noses, but she struck the ground with her foot as she moved, as if to some inaudible dance tune. And Inglewood, leaning quite quietly against the tree, had unconsciously clutched a branch and shaken it with a creative violence. Those giant gestures of man that made the high statues and the strokes of war tossed and tormented all their limbs. Silently, as they strolled and stood, they were bursting like batteries with an animal magnetism. "And now," cried Moon quite suddenly, stretching out a hand on each side, "let's dance round that bush." "Why, what bush do you mean?" asked Rosamund, looking round with a sort of radiant rudeness. "The bush that isn't there," said Michael, "the mulberry bush." They had taken each other's hands, half-laughing and quite ritually, and before they could disconnect again, Michael spun them all around like a demon spinning the world for a top. Diana felt, as the circle of the horizon flew instantaneously around her, a far aerial sense of the ring of heights beyond London and corners where she had climbed as a child. She seemed almost to hear the rooks cawing about the old pines on Highgate, or to see the glow-worms gathering and kindling in the woods of Box Hill. The end of section 7.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Man Alive by G. K. Chesterton. Section 8. Part 1. The Enigmas of Innocent Smith. Chapter 4. The Garden of the God. Part 2. The circle broke, as all such perfect circles of levity must break, and sent its author, Michael, flying, as by centrifugal force, far away against the blue rails of the gate. When reeling there, he suddenly raised shout after shout of a new and quite dramatic character. "Why, it's Warner!" he shouted, waving his arms. "It's jolly old Warner, with a new silk hat and the old silk mustache." "Is that Dr. Warner?" cried Rosamund, bounding forward in a burst of memory, amusement, and distress. "Oh, I am so sorry. Do tell him it's all right." "Let's take hands and tell him," said Michael Moon, for indeed, while they were talking, another hansom cab had dashed up behind the one already waiting, and Dr. Herbert Warner, leaving a companion in the cab, had carefully deposited himself on the pavement. "Now, when you are an eminent physician, and are wired for by an heiress to come to a case of dangerous mania, and when, as you come in through the garden to the house, the heiress and her landlady and two of the gentlemen boarders join hands and dance round you in a ring, calling out, 'It's all right, it's all right,' you're apt to be flustered and even displeased." Dr. Warner was a placid, but hardly a placable, person. The two things are by no means the same. And even when Moon explained to him that he, Warner, with his high hat and tall, solid figure, was just such a classic figure as ought to be danced round by a ring of laughing maidens on some old golden Greek seashore, even then he seemed to miss the point of the general rejoicing. "Inglewood," cried Dr. Warner, fixing his former disciple with a stare, "are you mad?" Arthur flushed to the roots of his brown hair, but he answered easily and quietly enough, "Not now. The truth is, Warner, I've just made a rather important medical discovery, quite in your line." "What do you mean?" asked the great doctor stiffly. "What discovery?" "I've discovered that health really is catching, like disease," answered Arthur. "Yes, sanity has broken out and is spreading," said Michael, performing a pas de seul with a thoughtful expression. 20,000 more cases taken to the hospitals, nurses employed night and day." Dr. Warner studied Michael's grave face and lightly moving legs with an unfathomed wonder. "And is this, may I ask, the sanity that is spreading?" "You must forgive me, Dr. Warner," cried Rosamund Hunt heartily. "I know I've treated you badly, but indeed it was all a mistake. I was in a frightfully bad temper when I sent for you, and now it all seems like a dream. And Mr. Smith is the sweetest, most sensible, most delightful old thing that ever existed, and may he marry anyone he likes, except me." "I should suggest Mrs. Duke," said Michael. The gravity of Dr. Warner's face increased. He took a slip of pink paper from his waistcoat pocket with his blue, pale eyes quietly fixed on Rosamund's face all the time. He spoke with a not inexcusable frigidity. "Really, Miss Hunt," he said, "you are not yet very reassuring. You sent me this wire only half an hour ago. Come at once, if possible, with another doctor. Man, Innocent Smith, gone mad on premises and doing dreadful things. Do you know anything of him?" "I went round at once to a distinguished colleague of mine, a doctor who is also a private detective and an authority on criminal lunacy, and he has come round with me and is waiting in the cab. Now you calmly tell me that this criminal madman is a highly sweet, sane old thing with accompaniments that set me speculating on your own definition of sanity. I hardly comprehend the change." "Oh, how can one explain a change in sun and moon and everybody's soul?" cried Rosamund in despair. "Must I confess we had got so morbid as to think him mad merely because he wanted to get married, and that we didn't even know it was only because we wanted to get married ourselves? We'll humiliate ourselves, if you like, Doctor. We're happy enough." "Where is Mr. Smith?" asked Warner of Inglewood very sharply. Arthur started. He had forgotten all about the central figure of their farce, who had not been visible for an hour or more. "I think he's on the other side of the house, by the dustbin," he said. "He may be on the road to Russia," said Warner, "but he must be found," and he strode away and disappeared round a corner of the house by the sunflowers. "I hope," said Rosamund, "he won't really interfere with Mr. Smith." "Interfere with the daisies?" said Michael with a snort. "A man can't be locked up for falling in love. At least I hope not." "No, I think even a doctor wouldn't make a disease out of him. He'd throw off the doctor like the disease, don't you know? I believe it's a case of a sort of holy well. I believe Innocent Smith is simply innocent, and that is why he is so extraordinary." It was Rosamund who spoke, restlessly tracing circles in the grass with the point of her white shoe. "I think," said Inglewood, "that Smith is not extraordinary at all. He's comic, just because he's so startlingly commonplace. Don't you know what it is to be all one family circle with aunts and uncles when a schoolboy comes home for the holidays? That bag there on the cab is only a schoolboy's hamper. This tree here in the garden is only the sort of tree that any schoolboy would have climbed. Yes, that's the thing that has haunted us all about him, the thing we could never fit a word to. Whether he is my old school fellow or no, at least he is all my old school fellows. He is the endless bun-eating, ball-throwing animal that we have all been." "That is only you absurd boys," said Diana. "I don't believe any girl was ever so silly, and I'm sure no girl was ever so happy, except..." And she stopped. "I will tell you the truth about Innocent Smith," said Michael Moon in a low voice. "Dr. Warner has gone to look for him in vain. He is not there. Haven't you noticed that we never saw him since we found ourselves? He was an astral baby born on all four of us. He was only our own youth returned. Long before poor old Warner had clambered out of his cab, the thing we called Smith had dissolved into dew and light on this lawn. Once or twice more, by the mercy of God, we may feel the thing, but the man we shall never see. In a spring garden before breakfast we shall smell the smell called Smith. In the snapping of brisk twigs in tiny fires we shall hear a noise named Smith. Everything insatiable and innocent in the grasses that gobble up the earth like babies at a bun feast. In the white mornings that split the sky as a boy splits up white firewood. We may feel for one instant the presence of an impetuous purity. But his innocence was too close to the unconsciousness of inanimate things not to melt back at a mere touch into the mild hedges and heavens he—" He was interrupted from behind the house by a bang like that of a bomb. Almost at the same instant the stranger in the cab sprang out of it,
leaving it rocking upon the stones of the road. He clutched the blue railings of the garden and peered eagerly over them in the direction of the noise. He was a small, loose, yet alert man, very thin, with a face that seemed made out of fish bones and a silk hat quite as rigid and resplendent as Warner's, but thrust back recklessly on the hinder part of his head. "Murder!" he shrieked in a high and feminine but very penetrating voice. "Stop that murder there!" Even as he shrieked, a second shot shook the lower windows of the house, and with the noise of it, Dr. Herbert Warner came flying round the corner like a leaping rabbit. Yet before he had reached the group, a third discharge had deafened them, and they saw with their own eyes two spots of white sky drilled through the second of the unhappy Herbert's high hats. The next moment the fugitive physician fell over a flower-pot and came down on all fours, staring like a cow. The hat with the two shot holes in it rolled upon the gravel path before him, and Innocent Smith came round the corner like a railway train. He was looking twice his proper size, a giant clad in green, the big revolver still smoking in his hand, his face sanguine and in shadow, his eyes blazing like all stars, and his yellow hair standing out all ways like Struwelpeter's. Though this startling scene hung but an instant in stillness, Inglewood had time to feel once more what he had felt when he saw the other lovers standing on the lawn, the sensation of a certain cut and coloured clearness that belongs rather to the thing of art than to the things of experience. The broken flower-pot with its red-hot geraniums, the green bulk of Smith and the black bulk of Warner, the blue-spiked railings behind, clutched by the stranger's yellow vulture claws and peered over by his long vulture neck, the silk hat on the gravel, and the little cloudlet of smoke floating across the garden as innocently as the puff of a cigarette. All these seemed unnaturally distinct and definite. They existed like symbols in an ecstasy of separation. Indeed, every object grew more and more particular and precious because the whole picture was breaking up. Things looked so bright just before they burst. Long before his fancies had begun, let alone ceased, Arthur had stepped across and taken one of Smith's arms. Simultaneously, the little stranger had run up the steps and taken the other. Smith went into peals of laughter and surrendered his pistol with a perfect willingness. Moon raised the doctor to his feet and then went, leaned suddenly on the garden gate. The girls were quiet and vigilant, as good women mostly are in instance of catastrophe. But their faces showed that somehow or other a light had been dashed out of the sky. The doctor himself, when he had risen, collected his hat and his wits, and dusting himself down with an air of great disgust, turned to them in brief apology. He was very white with his recent panic, but he spoke with perfect self-control. "You will excuse us, ladies," he said. "My friend and Mr. Inglewood are both scientists in their several ways. I think we had better all take Mr. Smith indoors and communicate with you later." And under the guard of the three natural philosophers, the disarmed Smith was led tactfully into the house, still roaring with laughter. From time to time, during the next 20 minutes, his distant boom of mirth could again be heard through the half-open window. But there came no echo of the quiet voices of the physicians. The girls walked about the garden together, rubbing up each other's spirits as best they might. Michael Moon still hung heavily against the gate. Somewhere about the expiration of that time, Dr. Warner came out of the house with a face less pale and even more stern, and the little man with the fishbone face advanced gravely in his rear. And if the face of Warner in the sunlight was that of a hanging judge, the face of the little man behind was more like a death's head. "Miss Hunt," said Dr. Herbert Warner, "I only wish to offer you my warm thanks and admiration. By your prompt courage and wisdom in sending for us by wire this evening, you have enabled us to capture and put out of mischief one of the most cruel and terrible of the enemies of humanity, a criminal whose plausibility and pitilessness have never before been combined in flesh." Rosamund looked across at him with a white, blank face and blinking eyes. "What do you mean?" she asked. "You can't mean Mr. Smith." "He has gone by many other names," said the doctor gravely, "and not one did he not leave to be cursed behind him. That man, Miss Hunt, has left a track of blood and tears across the world. whether he is mad as well as wicked, we are trying in the interests of science to discover. In any case, we shall have to take him to a magistrate first, even if only on the road to a lunatic asylum. But the lunatic asylum in which he is confined will have to be sealed with a wall within a wall, and ringed with guns like a fortress, or he will break out again to bring forth carnage and darkness on the earth. Rosamund looked at the two doctors, her face growing paler and paler. Then her eyes strayed to Michael, who was leaning on the gate. But he continued to lean on it without moving, with his face turned away toward the darkening road. End of chapter 4. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Man Alive by G.K. Chesterton. Section 9. Part 1. The Enigmas of Innocent Smith. Chapter 5. The Allegorical Practical Joker. Part 1. The criminal specialist who had come with Dr. Warner was a somewhat more urbane and even dapper figure than he had appeared when clutching the railings and craning his neck into the garden. He even looked comparatively young when he took his hat off, having fair hair parted in the middle and carefully curled on each side, and lively movements, especially of the hands. He had a dandified monocle slung round his neck by a broad black ribbon, and a big bow tie, as if a big American moth had alighted on him. His dress and gestures were bright enough for a boy's. It was only when you looked at the fishbone face that you beheld something acrid and old. His manners were excellent, though hardly English, and he had two half-conscious tricks by which people who only met him once remembered him. One was a trick of closing his eyes when he wished to be particularly polite. The other was one of lifting his joined thumb and forefinger in the air as if holding a pinch of snuff when he was hesitating or hovering over a word. But those who were longer in his company tended to forget these oddities in the stream of his quaint and solemn conversation and really singular views. "Miss Hunt," said Dr. Warner, "this is Dr. Cyrus Pym." Dr. Cyrus Pym shut his eyes during the introduction, rather as if he were playing fair in some child's game, and gave a prompt little bow which somehow suddenly revealed him as a citizen of the United States. "Dr. Cyrus Pym," continued Warner, Dr. Pym shut his eyes again, "is perhaps the first criminological expert of America. We are very fortunate to be able to consult with him in this extraordinary case." "I can't make head or tail of anything," said Rosamund. "How can poor Mr. Smith be so dreadful as he is by your account?" "Or by your telegram," said Herbert Warner, smiling. "Oh, you don't understand," cried the girl impatiently. "Why, he's done us all more good than going to church." "I think I can explain to the young lady," said Dr. Cyrus Pym. "This criminal, or maniac Smith, is a very genius of evil, and has a method of his own, a method of the most daring ingenuity. He is popular wherever he goes, for he invades every house as an uproarious child. People are getting suspicious of all the respectable disguises for a scoundrel, so he always uses the disguise of, what shall I say, the Bohemian? The blameless Bohemian? He always carries people off their feet. People are used to the mask of conventional good conduct. He goes in for eccentric good nature. You expect a Don Juan to dress up as a solemn and solid Spanish merchant, but you're not prepared when he dresses up as Don Quixote. You expect a humbug to behave like Sir Charles Grandison, because, with all respect, Miss Hunt, for the deep, tear-moving tenderness of Samuel Richardson, Sir Charles Grandison so often behaved like a humbug. But no real red-blooded citizen is quite ready for a humbug that models himself not on Sir Charles Grandison, but on Sir Roger de Coverley. Setting up to be a good man, a little cracked, is a new criminal incognito. Miss Hunt, it's been a great notion, and uncommonly successful, but its success just makes it mighty cruel." I can forgive Dick Turpin if he impersonates Dr. Busby. I can't forgive him when he impersonates Dr. Johnson. The saint with a tile loose is a bit too sacred, I guess, to be parodied." "But how do you know," cried Rosamund desperately, "that Mr. Smith is a known criminal?" "I collated all the documents," said the American, "when my friend Warner knocked me up on receipt of your cable. It is my professional affair to know these facts, Miss Hunt, and there's no more doubt about them than about the Bradshaw down at the depot. This man has hitherto escaped the law through his admirable affectations of infancy or insanity. But I myself, as a specialist, have privately authenticated notes of some 18 or 20 crimes attempted or achieved in this manner. He comes to houses, as he has to this, and gets a grand popularity. He makes things go. They do go. When he's gone, the things are gone. Gone, Miss Hunt, gone. A man's life, or a man's spoons, or more often a woman. I assure you I have all the memoranda." "I have seen them," said Warren solidly. "I can assure you that all this is correct." "The most unmanly aspect, according to my feelings," went on the American doctor, "is this perpetual deception of innocent women by a wild stimulation of innocence. From almost every house where this great imaginative devil has been, he has taken some poor girl away with him. Some say he's got a hypnotic eye with his other queer features, and that they go like automata. What's become of all those poor girls, nobody knows. Murdered, I dare say, for we've lots of instances, beside this one, of his turning his hand to murder, though none ever brought him under the law. Anyhow, our most modern methods of research can't find any trace of the wretched women. It's when I think of them that I am really moved, Miss Hunt, and I've really nothing else to say just now except what Dr. Warner has said." "Quite so," said Warner, with a smile that seemed molded in marble, "that we all have to thank you very much for that telegram." The little Yankee scientist had been speaking with such evident sincerity that one forgot the tricks of his voice and manner, the falling eyelids, the rising intonation, and the poised finger and thumb, which were at other times a little comic. It was not so much that he was cleverer than Warner. Perhaps he was not so clever, though he was more celebrated. But he had what Warner never had, a fresh and unaffected seriousness, the great American virtue of simplicity. Rosamund knitted her brows and looked gloomily toward the darkening house that contained the dark prodigy. Broad daylight still endured, but it had already changed from gold to silver, and was changing from silver to gray. The long plummy shadows of the one or two trees in the garden faded more and more upon a dead background of dusk. In the sharpest and deepest shadow, which was the entrance to the house by the big French windows, Rosamund could watch a hurried consultation between Inglewood, who was still left in charge of the mysterious captive, and Diana, who had moved to his assistance from without. After a few minutes and gestures, they went inside, shutting the glass doors upon the garden, and the garden seemed to grow grayer still. The American gentleman named Pym seemed to be turning and on the move in the same direction, but before he started he spoke to Rosamund with a flash of that guileless tact which redeemed much of his childish vanity, and with something of that spontaneous poetry which made it difficult, pedantic as he was, to call him a pedant. "I'm very sorry, Miss Hunt," he said, "but Dr. Warner and I, as two qualified practitioners, had better take Mr. Smith away in that cab, and the less said about it the better. Don't you agitate yourself, Miss Hunt. You've just got to think that we're taking away a monstrosity, something that oughtn't to be at all, something like one of those gods in your Britannic Museum, all wings and beards and legs and eyes and no shape. That's what Smith is, and you shall soon be quit of him." He had already taken a step toward the house, and Warner was about to follow him when the glass doors were opened again, and Diana Duke came out with more than her usual quickness across the lawn. Her face was aquiver with worry and excitement, and her dark, earnest eyes fixed only on the other girl. "Rosamund," she cried in despair, "what shall I do with her?" "With her?" cried Miss Hunt, with a violent jump. "Oh, Lord, he isn't a woman, too, is he?" "No, no, no," said Dr. Pym soothingly, as if in common fairness. "A woman? No, really, he's not so bad as that." "I mean your friend Mary Gray," retorted Diana with equal tartness. "What on earth am I to do with her?" "How can we tell her about Smith, you mean?" answered Rosamund, her face at once clouded and softening. "Yes, it will be pretty painful." "But I have told her," exploded Diana, with more than her congenital exasperation. "I have told her, and she doesn't seem to mind. She still says she's going away with Smith in that cab." "But it's impossible," ejaculated Rosamund. "Why, Mary is really religious. She stopped in time to realize that Mary Gray was comparatively close to her on the lawn. Her quiet companion had come down very quietly into the garden, but dressed very decisively for travel. She had a neat but very ancient blue tam-o'-shanter on her head, and was pulling some rather threadbare gray gloves onto her hands. Yet the two tints fitted excellently with her heavy copper-coloured hair, the more excellently for the touch of shabbiness, for a woman's clothes never suit her so well as when they seem to suit her by accident. But in this case the woman had a quality yet more unique and attractive. In such gray hours, when the sun is sunk and the skies are ready sad, it will often happen that one reflection at some occasional angle will cause to linger the last of the light. A scrap of window, a scrap of water, a scrap of looking-glass will be full of the fire that is lost to all the rest of the earth. The quaint, almost triangular face of Mary Gray was like some triangular piece of mirror that could still repeat the splendour of the hours before. Mary, though she was always graceful, could never before have properly been called beautiful, and yet her happiness amid all that misery was so beautiful as to make a man catch his breath. "Oh, Diana," cried Rosamund in a lower voice and altering her phrase, "but how did you tell her?" "It is quite easy to tell her," answered Diana somberly. "It makes no impression at all." "I'm afraid I kept everyone waiting," said Mary Gray apologetically, "and now we must really say good-bye. Innocent is taking me to his aunt's over at Hampstead, and I'm afraid she goes to bed early." Her words were quite casual and practical, but there was a sort of sleepy light in her eyes that was more baffling than darkness. She was like one speaking absently with her eyes on some very distant object. "Mary, Mary," cried Rosamund, almost breaking down, "I'm so sorry about it, but the thing can't be at all. We have found out all about Mr. Smith." "All?" repeated Mary, with a low and curious intonation. "Why, that must be awfully exciting." There was no noise for an instant, and no motion, except that the silent Michael Moon, leaning on the gate, lifted his head, as it might be to listen. Then Rosamund remained speechless. Dr. Pym came to her rescue in a definite way. "To begin with," he said, "this man Smith is constantly attempting murder." "The warden of Breakspear College." "I know," said Mary, with a vague but radiant smile. "Innocent told me." "I can't say what he told you," replied Pym quickly, "but I'm very much afraid it wasn't true. The plain truth is that the man's stained with every known human crime. I assure you I have all the documents. I have evidence of his committing burglary, signed by the most eminent English curate. I have." End of part one. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Man Alive by G.K. Chesterton. Section 10, Part 1, The Enigmas of Innocent Smith. Chapter 5, The Allegorical Practical Joker. Part 2. "Oh, but there were two curates," cried Mary, with a certain eagerness. "That was what made it so much funnier." The darkened glass doors of the house opened once more, and Inglewood appeared for an instant, making a sort of signal. The American doctor bowed, the English doctor did not, but they both set out stolidly toward the house. No one else moved, not even Michael, hanging on the gate. but the back of his head and shoulders had still an indescribable indication that he was listening to every word. "But don't you understand, Mary?" cried Rosamund in despair. "Don't you know that awful things have happened even before our very eyes? I should have thought you would have heard the revolver shot upstairs." "Yes, I heard the shot," said Mary, almost brightly, "but I was busy packing just then. An innocent had told me he was going to shoot at Dr. Warner, so it wasn't worth while to come down." "Oh, I don't understand what you mean," cried Rosamund Hunt, stamping, "but you must and shall understand what I mean. I don't care how cruelly I put it, if only I can save you. I mean that your innocent Smith is the most awfully wicked man in the world. He has sent bullets at lots of other men, and gone off in cabs with lots of other women, and he seems to have killed the women too, for nobody can find them." "He is really rather naughty sometimes," said Mary Gray, laughing softly as she buttoned her old gray gloves. "Oh, this is really mesmerism or something," cried Rosamond, and burst into tears. At the same moment the two black-clad doctors appeared out of the house with their great green-clad captive between them. He made no resistance, but was still laughing in a groggy and half-witted style. Arthur Inglewood followed in the rear, a dark and red study in the last shades of distress and shame. In this black, funereal, and painfully realistic style, the exit from Beacon House was made by a man whose entrance a day before had been affected by the happy leaping of a wall and the hilarious climbing of a tree. No one moved of the groups in the garden except Mary Gray, who stepped forward quite naturally, calling out, "Are you ready, Innocent? Our cab's been waiting for such a long time." "Ladies and gentlemen," said Dr. Warner firmly, "I must insist on asking this lady to stand aside. We shall have trouble enough as it is with the three of us in a cab." "But it is our cab," persisted Mary. "Why, there's Innocent's yellow bag on the top of it." "Stand aside," repeated Warner roughly. "And you, Mr. Moon, please be so obliging as to move a moment. Come, come, the sooner this ugly business is over, the better. And how can we open the gate if you will keep leaning on it?" Michael Moon looked at his long, lean forefinger and seemed to consider and reconsider this argument. "Yes," he said at last, "but how can I lean on the gate if you keep opening it?" "Oh, get out of the way," cried Warner almost good-humouredly. "You can lean on the gate any time." "No," said Moon reflectively. "Seldom the time and place and the blue gate altogether, and it all depends whether you come of an old country family. My ancestors leaned on gates before anyone had discovered how to open them." "Michael," cried Arthur Inglewood in a kind of agony, "are you going to get out of that way?" "Why, no, I think not," said Michael, after some meditation, and swung himself slowly round so that he confronted the company, while still in a lounging attitude occupying the path. "Hello," he called out suddenly, "what are you doing to Mr. Smith?" "Taking him away," answered Warner shortly, "to be examined." "Matriculation?" asked Moon brightly. "By a magistrate," said the other curtly. "And what other magistrate," cried Michael, raising his voice, "dares to try what befell on this free soil, save only the ancient and independent Dukes of Beacon? What other court dares to try one of our company, save only the High Court of Beacon? Have you forgotten that only this afternoon we flew the flag of independence and severed ourselves from all the nations of the earth?" "Michael," cried Rosamund, wringing her hands, "how can you stand there talking nonsense? Why, you saw the dreadful thing yourself. You were there when he went mad. It was you that helped the doctor up when he fell over the flower-pot." "And the High Court of Beacon," replied Moon with hauteur, "has special powers in all cases concerning lunatics, flower-pots, and doctors who fall down in gardens. It is our very first charter from Edward the First. Si medicus quisquam in horto prostatus." "Out of the way," cried Warner with sudden fury, "or we will force you out of it." "What," cried Michael Moon with a cry of hilarious fierceness, "shall I die in defence of this sacred pale? Will you paint these blue railings red with my gore?" And he laid hold of one of the blue spikes behind him.
As Inglewood had noticed earlier in the evening, the railing was loose and crooked at this place, and the painted iron staff and spearhead came away in Michael's hand as he shook it. "See," he cried, brandishing this broken javelin in the air, "the very lances round Beacon Tower leap up from their places to defend it. Ah, in such a place and hour, it is a fine thing to die alone." And in a voice like a drum, he rolled the noble lines of Ronsard. "Sakes alive," said the American gentleman, almost in an awed tone. Then he added, "Are there two maniacs here?"
"No, there are five," thundered Moon. "Smith and I are the only sane people left."
"Michael," cried Rosamund, "Michael, what does it mean?"
"It means bosh," roared Michael, and slung his painted spear, hurtling to the other end of the garden. "It means that doctors are bosh, and criminology is bosh, and Americans are bosh, much more bosh than our court of Beacon. It means, you fatheads, that Innocent Smith is no more mad or bad than the bird on that tree."
"But, my dear Moon," began Inglewood in his modest manner, "these gentlemen—"
"On the word of two doctors," exploded Moon again, without listening to anybody else. "Shut up in a private hell on the word of two doctors, and such doctors! Oh, my hat, look at 'em! Do just look at 'em! Would you read a book, or buy a dog, or go to a hotel on the advice of 20 such? My people came from Ireland and were Catholics. What would you say if I called a man wicked on the word of two priests?"
"But it isn't only their word, Michael," reasoned Rosamund. "They've got evidence, too."
"Have you looked at it?" asked Moon.
"No," said Rosamund, with a sort of faint surprise. "These gentlemen are in charge of it."
"And of everything else, it seems to me," said Michael. "Why, you haven't even had the decency to consult Mrs. Duke."
"Oh, but that's no use," said Diana, in an undertone to Rosamund. "And he can't say boo to a goose."
"I'm glad to hear it," answered Michael, "for with such a flock of geese to say it to, the horrid expletive might be constantly on her lips. For my part, I simply refuse to let things be done in this light and airy style. I appeal to Mrs. Duke. It's her house."
"Mrs. Duke," repeated Inglewood doubtfully.
"Yes, Mrs. Duke," said Michael firmly, "commonly called the Iron Duke."
"If you ask Auntie," said Diana quietly, "she'll only be for doing nothing at all. Her only idea is to hush things up or let things slide. That just suits her."
"Yes," replied Michael Moon, "and as it happens, it just suits all of us. You are impatient with your elders, Miss Duke, but when you are as old yourself, you will know what Napoleon knew, that half one's letters answer themselves if you can only refrain from the fleshly appetite of answering them."
He was still lounging in the same absurd attitude, with his elbow on the grate, but his voice had altered abruptly for the third time, just as it had changed from the mock heroic to the humanly indignant. It now changed to the airy incisiveness of a lawyer giving good legal advice.
"It isn't only your aunt who wants to keep this quiet, if she can," he said. "We all want to keep it quiet, if we can. Look at the large facts, the big bones of the case. I believe those scientific gentlemen have made a highly scientific mistake. I believe Smith is as blameless as a buttercup. I admit buttercups don't often let off loaded pistols in private houses. I admit there is something demanding of explanation, but I am morally certain there is some blunder, or some joke, or some allegory, or some accident behind all this. Well, suppose I'm wrong. We've disarmed him. We're five men to hold him. He may as well go to a lock-up later on as now. But suppose there's even a chance of my being right. Is it in anybody's interest to wash this linen in public? Come, I'll take each of you in order. Once take Smith outside that gate, and you take him into the front page of the evening papers. I know. I've written the front page myself, Miss Duke. Do you or your aunt want a sort of notice stuck up over your boarding house? Doctors shot here? No, no. Doctors are rubbish, as I said. But you don't want the rubbish shot here. Arthur, suppose I am right, or suppose I am wrong. Smith has appeared as an old-school fellow of yours. Mark my words, if he's proved guilty, the organs of public opinion will say you introduced him. If he's proved innocent, they will say you helped to collar him. Rosamund, my dear, suppose I am right or wrong. If he is proved guilty, they'll say you engaged your companion to him. If he's proved innocent, they'll print that telegram. I know the organs, damn them. He stopped an instant, for this rapid rationalism left him more breathless than had either his theatrical or his real denunciation. But he was plainly in earnest, as well as positive and lucid, as was proved by his proceeding quickly the moment he had found his breath. "It is just the same," he cried, "with our medical friends. You will say that Dr. Warner has a grievance. I agree. But does he want specially to be snapshotted by all the journalists, prostratus in horto? It was no fault of his, but the scene was not very dignified, even for him. He must have justice. But does he want to ask for justice, not only on his knees, but on his hands and knees? Does he want to enter the court of justice on all fours? Doctors are not allowed to advertise, and I'm sure no doctor wants to advertise himself as looking like that. And even for our American guest, the interest is the same. Let us suppose that he has conclusive documents. Let us assume that he has revelations really worth reading. Well, in a legal inquiry, or a medical inquiry for that matter, 10 to 1 he won't be allowed to read them. He'll be tripped up every 2 or 3 minutes with some tangle of old rules. A man can't tell the truth in public nowadays, but he can still tell it in private, and he can tell it inside that house. It is quite true, said Dr. Cyrus Pym, who had listened throughout the speech with a seriousness which only an American could have retained through such a scene. It is true that I have been perceptibly less hampered in private inquiries. Dr. Pym, cried Warder in a sort of sudden anger, Dr. Pym, you aren't really going to admit... End of Section 10. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Man Alive by G.K. Chesterton. Section 11. Part 1. The Enigmas of Innocent Smith. Chapter 5. The Allegorical Practical Joker. Part 3. Smith may be mad, went on the melancholy moon in a monologue that seemed as heavy as a hatchet, but there was something after all in what he said about home rule for every home. Yes, there is something, when all said and done, in the High Court of Beacon. It is really true that human beings might often get some sort of domestic justice where just now they can only get legal injustice. Oh, I'm a lawyer, too, and I know that as well. It is true that there isn't too much official and indirect power. Often and often, the thing a whole nation can't settle is just the thing a family could settle. Scores of young criminals have been fined and sent to jail when they ought to have been thrashed and sent to bed. Scores of men, I am sure, have had a lifetime at Hanwell when they only wanted a week at Brighton. There is something in Smith's notion of domestic self-government, and I propose that we put it into practice. You have the prisoner, you have the documents. Come, we are a company of free, white, Christian people, such as might be besieged in a town or cast up on a desert island. Let us do this thing ourselves. Let us go into that house there and sit down and find out with our own eyes and ears whether this thing is true or not. Whether this Smith is a man or a monster. If we can't do a little thing like that, what right have we to put crosses on ballots? Inglewood and Pym exchanged a glance, and Warner, who was no fool, saw in that glance that Moon was gaining ground. The motives that led Arthur to think of surrender were indeed very different from those which affected Dr. Cyrus Pym. All Arthur's instincts were on the side of privacy and polite settlement. He was very English, and would often endure wrongs rather than right them by scenes and serious rhetoric. To play at once the buffoon and the knight-errant, like his Irish friend, would have been absolute torture to him. But even the semi-official part he had played that afternoon was very painful. He was not likely to be reluctant if anyone could convince him that his duty was to let sleeping dogs lie. On the other hand, Cyrus Pym belonged to a country in which things are possible that seem crazy to the English. Regulations and authorities, exactly like one of Innocent's pranks or one of Michael's satires, really exist, propped by placid policemen and imposed on bustling businessmen. Pym knew whole states which are vast and yet secret and fanciful. Each is as big as a nation, yet as private as a lost village, and as unexpected as apple pie bed. States where no man may have a cigarette, states where any man may have 10 wives, very strict prohibition states, very lax divorce states. All these large local vagaries had prepared Cyrus Pym's mind for small local vagaries in a smaller country, infinitely more remote from England than any Russian or Italian, utterly incapable of even conceiving what English conventions are. He could not see the social impossibility of the Court of Beacon. It is firmly believed by those who shared the experiment that to the very end Pym believed in that phantasmal court, and supposed it to be some Britannic institution. Towards the synod, thus somewhat at a standstill, there approached through the growing haze and gloaming a short, dark figure with a walk apparently founded on the imperfect repression of a negro breakdown. Something at once in the familiarity and the incongruity of this being moved Michael to even heartier outbursts of a healthy and humane flippancy. "While here's little Nosey Gould," he exclaimed, "isn't the mere sight of him enough to banish all your morbid reflections?" "Really," replied Dr. Warner, "I really fail to see how Mr. Gould affects the question, and I once more demand—" "Hello! What's the funeral, gents?" inquired the newcomer with the air of an uproarious umpire. "Doctor demanding something? Always the way at a boarding-house, you know. Always lots of demand, no supply." As delicately and impartially as he could, Michael restated his position and indicated generally that Smith had been guilty of certain dangerous and dubious acts, and that there had even arisen an allegation that he was insane. "Well, of course he is," said Moses Gould equably. "It don't need old Ohms to see that. The 'awk-like face of Ohms," he added with abstract relish, "showed a shade of disappointment, the sleuth-like Gould having got there before him." "If he is mad," began Inglewood. "Well," said Moses, "when a cove gets out on the tile the first night, there's generally a tile loose." "You never objected before," said Diana Duke rather stiffly, "and you're generally pretty free with your complaints." "I don't complain of him," said Moses magnanimously. "The poor chap's armless enough. You might tie him up in the garden here, and he'd make noises at the burglars." "Moses," said Moon with solemn fervour, "you are the incarnation of common sense. You think Mr. Innocent is mad. Let me introduce you to the incarnation of scientific theory. He also thinks Mr. Innocent Smith is mad. Doctor, this is my friend Mr. Gould. Moses, this is the celebrated Dr. Pym." The celebrated Dr. Cyrus Pym closed his eyes and bowed. He also murmured his national war cry in a low voice which sounded like, "Pleased to meet you." "Now, you two people," said Michael cheerfully, "who both think our poor friend mad, shall jolly well go into that house over there and prove him mad. What could be more powerful than the combination of scientific theory with common sense? United you stand, divided you fall. I will not be so uncivil as to suggest that Dr. Pym has no common sense. I confine myself to recording the chronological accident that he has not shown us any so far. I take the freedom of an old friend in staking my shirt that Moses has no scientific theory. Yet against this strong coalition I am ready to appear armed with nothing but an intuition, which is American for a guess." "Distinguished by Mr. Gould's assistance," said Pym, opening his eyes suddenly, "I gather that, though he and I are identical in primary diagnosis, there is yet between us something that cannot be called a disagreement, something which we may perhaps call a—" He put the points of a thumb and forefinger together, spreading the other fingers exquisitely in the air, and seemed to be waiting for somebody else to tell him what to say. "Catchin' flies?" inquired the affable Moses.
"A divergence," said Dr. Pym, with a refined sigh of relief. "A divergence. Granted that the man in question is deranged, he would not necessarily be all that science requires in a homicidal maniac."
"Has it occurred to you," observed Moon, who was leaning on the gate again and did not turn round, "that if he were a homicidal maniac, he might have killed us all here while we were talking?" Something exploded silently underneath all their minds, like sealed dynamite in some forgotten cellars. They all remembered for the first time, for some hour or two, that the monster of whom they were talking was standing quietly among them. They had left him in the garden, like a garden statue. There might have been a dolphin coiling round his legs, or a fountain pouring out of his mouth, for all the notice they had taken of Innocent Smith. He stood with his crest of blonde, blown hair thrust somewhat forward, his fresh-coloured, rather short-sighted face looking patiently downwards at nothing in particular, his huge shoulders humped and his hands in his trousers pockets. So far as they could guess, he had not moved at all. His green coat might have been cut out of the green turf on which he stood. In his shadow, Pym had expounded and Rosamund expostulated, Michael had ranted and Moses had ragged. He had remained, like a thing graven, the god of the garden. A sparrow had perched on one of his heavy shoulders, and then, after correcting its costume of feathers, had flown away. "Why," cried Michael with a shout of laughter, "the court of Beacon has opened. And shut up again, too. You all know now I am right. Your buried common sense has told you what my buried common sense has told me. Smith might have fired off 100 cannons instead of a pistol, and you would still know he was harmless, as I know he is harmless. Back we all go to the house and clear a room for discussion, for the High Court of Beacon, which has already arrived at its decision, is just about to begin its inquiry." "Just going to begin," cried little Mr. Moses, in an extraordinary sort of disinterested excitement, like that of an animal during a music or a thunderstorm. "Follow on to the High Court of Eggs and Bacon. Have a kipper from the old firm. Its lordship complimented Mr. Gould on the high professional delicacy he had shown, and which was worthy of the best traditions of the saloon bar, and three of Scotch hot. Miss, oh, chase me, girls." The girls betrayed no temptation to chase him. He went away in a sort of waddling dance of pure excitement, and had made a circuit of the garden before he reappeared breathless, but still beaming. Moon had known his man when he realized that no people presented to Moses Gould could be quite serious, even if they were quite furious. The glass door stood open on the side nearest to Mr. Moses Gould, and as the feet of that festive idiot were evidently turned in the same direction, everybody else went that way with the unanimity of some uproarious procession. Only Diana Duke retained enough rigidity to say the thing that had been boiling at her fierce feminine lips for the last few hours. Under the shadow of tragedy, she had kept it back as unsympathetic. "In that case," she said sharply, "these cabs can be sent away." "Well, Innocent must have his bag, you know," said Mary with a smile. "I dare say the cabman would get it down for us." "I'll get the bag," said Smith, speaking for the first time in hours. His voice sounded remote and rude, like the voice of a statue. Those who had so long danced and disputed round his immobility were left breathless by his precipitance. With a run and spring he was out of the garden into the street. With a spring and one quivering kick he was actually on the roof of the cab. The cabman happened to be standing by the horse's head, having just removed its emptied nose-bag. Smith seemed for an instant to be rolling about on the cab's back in the embraces of his Gladstone bag. The next instant, however, he had rolled, as if by a royal luck, into the high seat behind, and with a shriek of piercing and appalling suddenness had sent the horse flying and scampering down the street. His evanescence was so violent and swift that this time it was all the other people who were turned into garden statues. Mr. Moses Gould, however, being ill-adapted both physically and morally for the purposes of permanent sculpture, came to life some time before the rest, and turning to Moon remarked, like a man standing chattily with a stranger on an omnibus, "Tile loose, huh? Cab loose, anyhow." There followed a fatal silence, and then Dr. Warner said with a sneer like a club of stone, "This is what comes of the Court of Beacon, Mr. Moon. You have let loose a maniac on the whole metropolis." Beacon House stood, as it has been said, at the end of a long crescent of continuous houses. The little garden that shut it in ran out into a sharp point like a green cape pushed into the sea of two streets. Smith and his cab shot up one side of the triangle, and certainly most of those standing inside of it never expected to see him again. At the apex, however, he turned the horse sharply round and drove with equal violence up the other side of the garden. Visible to all those in the group, with a common impulse, the little crowd ran across the lawn as if to stop him. But they soon had reason to duck and recoil. Even as he vanished up the street for the second time, he let the big yellow bag fly from his hand, so that it fell in the center of the garden, scattering the company like a bomb, and nearly damaging Dr. Warner's hat for the third time. Long before they had collected themselves, the cab had shot away with a shriek that went into a whisper. "Well," said Michael Moon, with a queer note in his voice, "you may as well all go inside anyhow. We've got two relics of Mr. Smith, at least, his fiancée and his trunk." "Why do you want us to go inside?" asked Arthur Inglewood, in whose red brow and rough brown hair botheration seemed to have reached its limit. End of section 11.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.